Was Rome a democracy? The Republic, the people, and a modern misconception. Rome was a republic, not a democracy. The statement is repeated so often that it has acquired the comfortable authority of something that no longer needs to be examined. Rome was a republic. Athens was a democracy. The distinction seems elementary and appears in textbooks, documentaries, and popular histories, neatly dividing the ancient Mediterranean into political categories familiar to the modern reader. There is, however, a difficulty with it. A republic and a democracy are not opposites. The words answer different questions. A republic describes, broadly speaking, a political community in which public affairs belong to the community rather than being the private possession of a hereditary ruler. Democracy describes the participation of the people in political authority. A state may therefore be republican without being democratic, but it can equally be, as Rome itself demonstrates, republican while containing substantial democratic institutions. The Romans themselves would probably have found our neat distinction rather strange. The Latin res publica did not originally mean what a modern reader normally understands by the word republic, a state without a king, governed by elected representatives and perhaps headed by a president. Literally, it was the public thing, the common affair. Cicero gave the idea one of its most memorable formulations in De Re Publica. Res publica, res populi. The Republic is the affair of the people. For Cicero, the populace was not simply a crowd inhabiting a territory, but a political association united by agreement concerning law and by common interest. The res publica therefore existed because there was a populace whose common affair it was. The people, moreover, were not merely an abstraction. Roman citizens elected magistrates, accepted or rejected legislation, assembled in formally constituted political bodies, conferred office upon the men who governed them, and elected tribunes, whose particular purpose was to protect citizens against the exercise of magisterial power. In certain circumstances, they also possessed important judicial functions. The Roman citizen body was therefore not an audience assembled merely to applaud decisions already taken elsewhere. It was part of the constitutional machinery of the state. None of this made Rome an egalitarian democracy, and it certainly did not make it Athens. But before deciding that Rome was not a democracy, we might reasonably ask how much political power a people must possess before the word democracy becomes applicable at all. Fortunately, we are not dependent entirely upon modern reconstruction. One of the most intelligent observers of the Roman political system confronted essentially the same problem more than 2,000 years ago. Polybius was a Greek, and that gave him something extremely useful: distance. He knew Greek constitutional theory, and when he attempted in the 2nd century BC to explain Rome's astonishing rise to power, he devoted much of the 6th book of his Histories to its political system. What he found refused to fit neatly into the conventional categories. Look at the consuls, Polybius argued, and Rome could appear almost monarchical. They commanded armies and exercised enormous executive authority. Look instead at the Senate, and Rome appeared aristocratic, with that body controlling much of the practical direction of government, finance, foreign relations, and administration. Yet when Polybius turned to the people, he found a democratic element which could not simply be ignored. His answer was not to decide that one of these descriptions must be correct and the others wrong, but that Rome combined all three. Its remarkable strength came precisely from the interaction between monarchical, aristocratic, and democratic elements. We need not accept Polybius uncritically. The practical influence of the senatorial aristocracy was enormous, and the balance he describes was never an equality between three neatly separated powers. But that does not diminish the point relevant here. A Greek political thinker, thoroughly familiar with demokratia, could look at Rome and identify a democratic component substantial enough to require explanation. The people elected magistrates and decided questions placed before their assemblies. The highest men in Rome could possess ancestry, wealth, clients, and reputation, but they still had to seek election. A consul was not appointed by the Senate, and a praetor did not inherit his office. The great aristocratic families dominated political competition, certainly, but candidates ultimately had to submit themselves to a voting process. The famous abbreviation that still survives on Roman monuments expresses this constitutional duality beautifully. SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus, the Senate and the Roman people. Not merely the Senate. Here, however, the democratic argument encounters its first serious difficulty. Who counted as the people? Certainly not everyone living under Roman rule. Women did not vote, slaves did not vote, and foreigners did not vote. For much of Roman history, enormous numbers of people governed by Rome possessed no Roman citizenship, and therefore no participation in Roman elections. Even among citizens, political influence was anything but equal. This is frequently presented as sufficient reason to deny Rome any democratic description. But if it is sufficient, another problem immediately appears. Athens. Classical Athens is routinely described as the birthplace of democracy. The word itself is Greek, yet Athenian democracy excluded women, slaves, and resident foreigners from political participation. We do not therefore conclude that Athens was not democratic. We describe it more accurately as a democracy of male citizens. Why should Rome automatically be subjected to a completely different test?
This does not erase the differences between Athens and Rome. They were considerable. Athens developed forms of direct citizen government much more extensive than anything Rome created. Rome remained dominated socially and politically by an aristocratic elite, and its political culture was hierarchical to a degree that makes any suggestion of egalitarianism absurd. But democracy and equality are not synonyms. The more useful question is therefore not whether Roman democracy satisfies 21st century standards. It obviously does not. But whether Rome contained institutions that we would recognize as democratic when judging the ancient world on its own terms. Here, the easy distinction between democratic Athens and republican Rome begins to look considerably less secure. Imagine an ordinary Roman citizen arriving to vote. He does not elect a representative who then enters a legislature and votes on laws for him for the next several years. There is no Roman House of Commons Congress, or Bundestag. A magistrate has proposed a measure. It has passed through the procedures required before the vote, and the appropriate assembly is summoned. Citizens are organized into the voting units prescribed for that assembly and cast their votes, with the result determining whether the proposal is accepted or rejected. The system was cumbersome and unequal. The presiding magistrate controlled much of the procedure. Citizens could not simply introduce legislation from the floor. Religious procedures could interrupt proceedings. And patronage, political organization, and intimidation could influence the result. Nevertheless, the final act remains unmistakable. Citizens voted directly upon legislation. That fact becomes particularly interesting when Rome is compared not merely with Athens, but with ourselves. Most citizens living in what we now call democracies rarely vote directly upon national legislation. We elect representatives who do so for us. And representative democracy has become so familiar that we tend almost unconsciously to regard representation as democracy itself. The Romans did something different. In this limited but important respect, Roman government contained an element of direct popular decision-making, absent from the everyday operation of many modern representative democracies. This does not make Rome more democratic than a modern democracy. It merely demonstrates that political systems cannot conveniently be placed upon a single line running from undemocratic to democratic. Rome was a mixture, and Polybius had understood precisely that.
There was, of course, a catch. To say that Roman citizens voted is not the same as saying that every Roman citizen possessed equal political influence. The most striking example was the Comitia Centuriata, the Centuriate Assembly. Citizens did not simply gather and have every individual vote added to a national total. They voted within centuries, and those centuries produced the votes determining the result. The organization of the assembly changed during Republican history, but its structure consistently gave substantial advantages to wealthier citizens. Property, rank, family, and reputation all influenced a Roman's political prospects, and behind nearly all of them stood the considerable advantage of wealth. Outside the formal voting arrangements, money produced advantages no statute needed to spell out. A wealthy Roman could cultivate clients, finance public displays, acquire the education and leisure necessary for political life, maintain relationships with other influential families, and, not least, make himself visible. A poor citizen might possess a theoretical right to seek certain offices, but that did not mean he possessed a realistic chance of obtaining them. There is, therefore, an important distinction between having the legal right to compete for political power and possessing the resources necessary to compete successfully. A constitution may leave the door formally open while society quietly establishes a price of admission. Roman politics had always been competitive. Ambition was not regarded as a defect in an aristocratic Roman. Properly directed, it was almost a duty. A man of distinguished family was expected to serve the state, seek magistracies, command armies, win distinction, and add honours to the reputation inherited from his ancestors. The problem was not ambition itself, but the increasing expense involved in satisfying it.
candidates had to cultivate voters, clients, and friends, appear at public occasions, support dependents, finance games, and display the generosity expected of men seeking public distinction. For some ambitious politicians, the costs became enormous. Debt could accompany political advancement, while the rewards associated with successful office holding and provincial command made victory correspondingly valuable. The Republic eventually legislated repeatedly against electoral corruption. The Romans called electoral bribery ambitus, and the proliferation of laws attempting to control it tells us something important. A society rarely legislates repeatedly against a problem that does not exist. Electoral corruption, however, was more complicated than a dishonest candidate handing coins to a dishonest voter. Money did not have to purchase a vote directly. It could purchase the conditions under which votes were won. It could provide visibility, connections, public generosity, influence, and obligation. This was a much more sophisticated form of political power, and consequently, a much more difficult one to regulate. The Republic could prohibit bribery, but it could neither prohibit wealth nor prevent wealth from producing political influence. Money alone did not destroy the Republic. Something more fundamental began to change. Rome possessed no single written constitutional document. Its political system rested upon statutes, institutions, religious rules, and an immense accumulation of precedent and convention. Much of the behaviour expected of political actors was contained in what Romans called the mos maiorum, the customs of the ancestors. The Republic, consequently, depended to a remarkable degree upon restraint, upon the assumption that possessing a legal or constitutional power did not necessarily mean that it should always be exercised to its furthest possible limit. There are things governments do not do, not because a policeman would arrest them if they tried, but because generations have agreed that such things are simply not done. Until someone does them.
The careers of Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus exposed this weakness with extraordinary clarity. In 133 BC, Tiberius Gracchus, tribune of the plebs, pursued an agrarian program concerned with the occupation of public land. When another tribune, Marcus Octavius, used his veto to obstruct the measure, Tiberius appealed to the popular assembly and had Octavius removed from office. There was a democratic logic to his argument. If a tribune existed to protect and represent the people, what legitimacy did he retain when he deliberately frustrated what Tiberius presented as the people's will? But another principle stood against it: the independence and sacrosanct position of the tribunate. Two constitutional principles could therefore possess legitimacy and point in opposite directions. Who was to decide between them? The Senate? The tribunes? The people? Or tradition? Rome possessed no constitutional court capable of providing a final, binding interpretation, and ultimately, the answer was political. Unfortunately, Roman politics was becoming less restrained. Tiberius was not defeated at an election or removed through an ordinary judicial process. He was killed. A group led by the Pontifex Maximus, Scipio Nasica, attacked Tiberius and his supporters, and his body was thrown into the Tiber. Whatever judgment one makes about Tiberius's own methods, a barrier had been crossed.
political disagreement had become political killing. And little more than a decade later, his brother Gaius would die amid another explosion of political violence. Rome had learned that extraordinary political methods could work and that violence could answer them. Once a political community has learned such lessons, forgetting them is difficult. What is striking about the subsequent deterioration of the Republic is how much of its constitutional structure remained intact while this was happening. Consuls continued to be elected, the Senate continued to meet, tribunes continued to hold office, assemblies continued to vote, and laws continued to be passed. There was no morning on which Roman citizens awoke to discover that somebody had officially cancelled the Republic. Instead, the behaviour surrounding its institutions changed. This matters because we often imagine the death of democracy as a dramatic event involving a tyrant, soldiers in the streets, and the formal abolition of constitutional government. History sometimes provides such theatrical clarity, but often it does not. Institutions can remain standing while the assumptions that made them function deteriorate around them. An election may still be an election, while money increasingly determines who can realistically compete. A veto may remain perfectly constitutional, while being used in ways earlier generations would have regarded as destructive. Political prosecutions may remain lawful, while becoming weapons against rivals, and public officials may continue invoking the Constitution while exploiting every ambiguity it contains. Nothing needs formally to disappear for the nature of the political system to begin changing. The Romans themselves eventually recognized that something profound had happened, and few expressed it more mercilessly than Sallust. Looking back upon the deterioration of Roman political life, he did not primarily blame defective constitutional machinery. For him, the destruction of Carthage had removed the great external fear that had helped discipline Roman society. With Rome's principal rival gone and imperial wealth pouring into the Republic, avaritia and ambitio, greed and ambition, expanded without their former restraints. Sallust's explanation is moralistic, but that does not make it trivial. He understood something institutional descriptions can easily overlook. A constitution cannot operate independently of the political culture inhabiting it. The best designed balance of powers becomes useless if every participant attempts to break the balance. Legal protections become fragile if citizens accept their violation whenever the victim belongs to the opposing faction, and rules cease to restrain when victory becomes more important than the legitimacy of the contest. Rome had become richer beyond anything earlier generations could have imagined. Successful commanders acquired fortunes and reputations on unprecedented scales. Provincial government offered opportunities for enrichment. Public contracts created immense private wealth. Land accumulated and luxury expanded. At the same time, Rome's political machinery remained essentially that of a city-state attempting to govern an empire. The rewards of political success had become enormous, and so had the consequences of political defeat.
A functioning republic inevitably requires politicians to accept such defeat. Elections produce losers, proposals fail, terms of office end, and even the most ambitious politician must occasionally watch an opponent govern in his place. None of this is particularly agreeable to people who have spent much of their lives trying to acquire political power. But it is indispensable to
to republican government. The system can survive only for as long as today's loser remains reasonably confident that there will be another contest tomorrow, and that losing this one will not mean his political, financial, or personal destruction. This was precisely where the late Roman Republic became increasingly dangerous. The consequences of defeat had grown considerably. A politician might carry enormous debts, face prosecution by his enemies once he left office, lose his political standing, or even be driven into exile. Under such circumstances, winning was no longer simply desirable. For some men, it could become a matter of political survival. And the willingness to respect conventions that might deliver victory to an enemy inevitably weakened. This is why the final century of the Republic cannot satisfactorily be explained by choosing one villain. Marius, Sulla, Pompey, Clodius, Cato, Caesar, Antony, or Octavian can each be made to carry a greater or lesser portion of the blame, and choosing the man one dislikes most makes the story reassuringly simple. Republics, however, are rarely destroyed by one man acting upon a perfectly healthy political society. The man who finally breaks a door normally discovers that its hinges have already been loosened. This brings us inevitably to Caesar, who for generations has provided a convenient answer to an extraordinarily complicated question. Why did the Roman Republic fall? Because Julius Caesar destroyed it. The chronology alone makes such an explanation difficult. Caesar was born into a republic whose political violence had already begun, and was a child when Marius and Sulla fought for control of Rome. He grew up in a society that had already seen Roman armies used in Roman political conflicts, citizens proscribed and killed, property confiscated, and constitutional arrangements rewritten by a dictator. Caesar did not teach Rome that an army could determine politics. Sulla had already demonstrated that. He did not introduce political murder, because that boundary had been crossed decades before him. Nor did he invent extraordinary commands, electoral corruption, aristocratic debt, or the use of popular institutions against senatorial resistance. All belonged to the political world he inherited. None of this absolves Caesar of responsibility for his own actions. Crossing the Rubicon had enormous consequences. His dictatorship concentrated powers difficult to reconcile with normal republican government, and the accumulation of honours around him understandably alarmed men who believed that the traditional balance was disappearing. But Caesar can be responsible for accelerating the Republic's terminal crisis without having created the conditions that produced it. The two propositions are not contradictory. By 49 BC, the question was no longer merely whether Roman politicians respected the constitution. It was, which interpretation of the constitution would prevail? Who possessed the authority to enforce it? And whether the loser would accept the result. Caesar feared that surrendering his command and returning without political protection would expose him to prosecution and political destruction. His opponents feared that allowing him to retain his military and political position threatened the independence of the Republic. Each side could construct an argument, each could portray the other as the aggressor, and each could claim to defend liberty. The more serious problem was that neither trusted the other sufficiently to lose. That is no longer a healthy constitutional dispute. It is the condition from which civil wars grow. At this point, it may be useful to leave Rome for a moment and imagine another republic, 2,000 years later. It is large, wealthy, and extraordinarily powerful. Its citizens elect their leaders. Political authority is divided among institutions intended to restrain one another. Its highest executive magistrate cannot legally remain in office indefinitely. Its legislature possesses substantial powers. Its courts can restrain political action, and its citizens regard their constitution with something approaching civic reverence.
No law requires a candidate for its highest office to possess an immense fortune, and in theory, a citizen of comparatively modest means may aspire to it. In practice, seriously competing for that office requires access to sums beyond anything an ordinary citizen could conceivably possess. The candidate need not personally be enormously wealthy. It is sufficient that enormously wealthy people are willing to support him. Campaigns cost fortunes. Political organizations raise and spend extraordinary sums. Candidates cultivate donors, and donors acquire access. Personal wealth can also allow candidates to enter political competition without the financial dependence experienced by others. None of this means that votes are simply purchased. The citizen still decides. The ballot remains secret. The result remains uncertain. The opposition can win, and governments can change. This is a democracy. The question Rome encourages us to ask is not whether money has abolished democracy, but whether enormous concentrations of money can alter the environment in which democratic choices are made. There is an obvious difference between the political resources available to an ordinary citizen and those available to a person capable of financing campaigns, organizations, or attempts to persuade millions of voters. Both possess one vote and are constitutionally equal in that respect. Their ability to influence the political process surrounding those votes is plainly not equal. The Romans would have understood the distinction perfectly. Money, however, was not what finally killed the Roman Republic, and the more disturbing comparison lies elsewhere. Late Republican politics progressively weakened the distinction between an opponent and an enemy. An opponent is somebody one wishes to defeat within the political system. An enemy is somebody whose victory one regards as intolerable to the continued existence of that system. The difference is enormous, because Republican government depends upon the existence of opponents. One faction proposes, and another resists. One wins an election, and another loses. Policies change, laws are challenged, and political power changes hands. The process is frustrating, because political frustration is part of the price of peaceful government. A republic enters much more dangerous territory when substantial numbers of citizens become convinced that victory by the opposing side would itself constitute the destruction of the republic. If an opponent is merely wrong, rules must still be observed. If that opponent is regarded as an existential threat, breaking those same rules can suddenly be presented as an act of patriotism. Rome repeatedly approached its political crises in precisely this fashion. Each emergency made the next emergency easier to imagine, and each extraordinary remedy enlarged the collection of precedents available to the next politician, who could claim to be facing extraordinary circumstances. Perhaps one of the most dangerous arguments in Republican politics
follows naturally from this development. The other side did it first. The Romans became increasingly familiar with its logic. One violation could justify another. One extraordinary command could provide a precedent for the next. Political violence made retaliation understandable, and manipulation of constitutional procedure could be answered with counter-manipulation. The difficulty was that the grievances were often genuine. Each side could point to things the other had actually done and ask why it should continue respecting conventions its opponents had already ignored. The questions arising from this are not irrational, which is precisely what makes them dangerous. Why accept defeat when one suspects the opponent would not? Why refrain from using a legal power merely because earlier generations used it sparingly? Why compromise with people believed to threaten everything one considers essential? A republic does not necessarily collapse because its citizens suddenly become foolish. It can collapse because intelligent people, responding quite rationally to increasingly hostile incentives, collectively produce an outcome almost none of them originally wanted. This may be the most important lesson Rome offers a modern democratic republic. A constitution cannot save a republic by itself. The Romans possessed laws, elections, magistracies, vetoes, term limits, elaborate procedures, and an enormous body of precedent. And yet, they lost the republic. The failure was not that somebody had forgotten to write one additional rule. Their political system gradually became incapable of containing the ambitions, fears, and hatreds operating within it.
Sallust understood this as a question of character, and later observers, among them Mommsen, repeatedly returned to the deterioration of the political and social culture surrounding Rome's constitutional crisis. Modern historians are understandably suspicious of explanations based solely upon moral decline. Economic change, imperial expansion, military transformation, and institutional weakness all mattered. But removing character entirely produces another error, because institutions are operated by people. A magistrate must decide how far to stretch his authority. A senator, whether to respect a convention. A defeated candidate, whether to accept defeat. And a victorious faction, whether to humiliate its opponents. Citizens themselves must decide whether a constitutional violation becomes acceptable because it benefits their side. At every point, character enters the constitution. We can finally return to the question in the title. Was Rome a democracy? If by democracy we mean a society of equal citizens exercising equal political influence, the answer is plainly no. Although such a definition would eliminate most democracies that have ever existed. If instead we ask whether Roman citizens possessed meaningful constitutional power through elections, assemblies, legislation, and the tribunate, the answer must be yes. Rome was therefore neither simply democratic nor simply aristocratic, and Polybius's mixed constitution remains considerably more useful than the modern slogan, a republic, not a democracy. Rome was a republic containing democratic institutions, and that makes its history considerably more relevant to democratic republics than the familiar distinction allows us to believe. There is comfort in imagining ancient Rome as fundamentally different from ourselves. An aristocratic and slave-owning society, a violent world of patrons, clients, generals, mobs, and immense inequality, whose collapse can safely be observed from a distance. But once we recognize that Roman citizens elected officials, voted upon legislation, defended political liberties, distrusted concentrated power, and believed passionately in their republic, that distance becomes smaller. It becomes smaller still when we recognize some of the circumstances accompanying the deterioration. Politics becoming extraordinarily expensive. Wealth acquiring political influence without formally acquiring additional votes. Constitutional powers being pushed further because the law technically permits it. Conventions increasingly regarded as obstacles rather than restraints. Political opponents becoming enemies. Factions convinced that only their own victory can save the Republic. Extraordinary measures justified by extraordinary circumstances, and the behaviour of one side continually used to excuse the behaviour of the other. None of this means that another republic displaying some of these characteristics must follow Rome. History does not repeat itself with such precision, and modern states possess institutions Rome never imagined. Representative legislatures, professional judiciaries, mass education, universal citizenship, enormous administrative systems, and constitutional structures developed through centuries of political experience make any simple equation meaningless. Nor does fierce political disagreement itself signify decline. Democracy is, after all, disagreement organized peacefully. The danger begins when citizens cease believing that disagreement can safely continue. When losing an election begins to feel indistinguishable from losing the country. When constitutional restraint is demanded from opponents but regarded as optional for friends. When wealth does not formally purchase office, but increasingly determines who can realistically seek it. Or when every election is described as the last opportunity to save the Republic. Rome offers no formula telling us precisely when that point has been reached, and the Romans themselves did not know. That may be the warning. They continued to call their state the Res Publica, continued to elect magistrates, convene the Senate, and invoke liberty, while accusing one another of destroying it. Even after Caesar was dead, the men who killed him believed that removing the supposed tyrant would restore the Republic. Instead, another civil war followed, then another, until eventually a young man accumulated a degree of power Caesar himself had never securely possessed. Augustus was careful with words and understood Roman political memory. He did not need to call himself king, nor did he need to announce that the Republic had ended. The Senate remained, consuls continued to be elected, magistracies survived, and the language of the Res Publica survived with them. He had understood something his predecessors had learned at terrible cost. The forms could remain after the substance had changed.
Perhaps that is why the commonplace with which we began is not merely inaccurate, but unfortunate. Rome was not important because it was a republic rather than a democracy. It is important because it was a republic with substantial democratic institutions. And because those institutions proved insufficient when the political culture supporting them deteriorated. The question Rome leaves us is therefore not simply whether our institutions are democratic,
Our constitutions can answer that. The more difficult question is whether the habits, restraints, and assumptions that allow democratic institutions to function are still alive. No constitution can answer that for us.